This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Resistance is Futile, How the Trump-Hating Left Lost Its Collective Mind. This is the author, Ann Coulter. For Floyd Resnick. Chapter 1. The Resistance. Trump is Hitler times infinity. There is a whole group of Americans whose sole political position is, we hate Trump. From the moment he won the election, it has been total war against the president, like nothing this country has experienced before. The left is in a panic. The liberal position on any issue can be summarized as, where's Trump on this? Oh, that's awful. Things that never bothered liberals in the past, Russia, vulgarity, the supremacy clause, are now hateful. The things they used to hate have become beloved institutions. The FBI, the CIA, Mormons, and the Bush family. The resistance doesn't care about Trump's positions. They couldn't name his positions. The problem is aesthetic. Liberals can't abide having that vulgarian in the Oval Office. Yes, liberals thought Bush was an ignorant boob, but they mostly expressed their disdain with dismissive eye rolls. They held Reagan in contempt, confused about how to respond to a confident conservative, something they'd never encountered before. No one could say Nixon was dumb, so he was mocked as weird and stiff. Trump is something different. It's not only who he is that enrages them, but whom he replaced. Liberals absolutely adored Obama. Often obscenely so. Liberal women openly boasted about dreaming of having sex with him. Even MSNBC's Chris Matthews got a thrill up his leg. They didn't care about Obama's positions either. He's the mirror image of Trump. Obama was cool, elegant, slender, looked great in clothes. The fact that he was black was just a super bonus. Fanatically supporting Obama meant they got to have a black friend. Liberals liked that he was against the Iraq War, but would have supported him even if he weren't. To go from Obama to the crudest kind of parvenu, bragging about his wealth and IQ with gold-plated everything, was too much. It would be like having Fred Astaire as your president and then getting Rodney Dangerfield. We get it, liberals. You hate Trump. But you've convinced yourselves that he poses some kind of existential threat when your real objection is that you think he's a douchebag. The resistance thinks indignation gives their apoplexy dignity. Instead of admitting they're enraged that this clown moved into Obama's house, liberals say, the nation is in crisis. On election night, NBC's Mark Halperin informed Stephen Colbert's audience, outside of the Civil War, World War II, and including 9/11, this may be the most cataclysmic event the country's ever seen. Since then, it's been a game of one-upmanship to see who can issue the most shocking denunciation of Trump. Liberals weren't always this excitable. They used to pride themselves on their detached view of the passing scene, sneering at the lowbrow's tendency to overreact. I thought the whole thing about being cool was to be cool. But since Trump's election, liberals are the ones hyperventilating over nothing and devoting their lives to demented conspiracy theories. Conservatives are the cool ones, refusing to freak out over every little thing. Remember that time Trump invaded Poland? If you're into self-dramatization, Donald Trump's presidency is perfect for you. You get to be the princess who first felt the pee under 15 layers of mattresses. I'm afraid! Psychologists are treating patients for Trump anxiety. Plotting and not-bright writers have produced lengthy historical analogies comparing Trump to Hitler, George Wallace, and Bull Connor, breathless with their sense of the inherent drama. As I predicted, the New York Times' David Brooks was one of the first out of the box with a column on Trump's, quote, authoritarian personality. In a deadly earnest column, He warned that Trump was making, quote, the argument of nearly every demagogue since the dawn of time. Trump, he said, was playing on fears that had proved to be contagious and moved populations. Like George Wallace, the GOP nominee was presiding over less a party than a personality cult. Trump's supporters just thought they were being lied to, which they were. They thought they were being dismissed, which they were. The ruling class can do that for only so long before people begin to notice. Days before Trump's inauguration, John Dean said, "The American presidency has never been at the whims of an authoritarian personality like Donald Trump." You could predict every hysterical column. Watching the rise of Donald Trump, I am struck continually by recognition of an historical epoch that I had naively hoped was well buried in the past. Trump's candidacy has released all the darkest passions. Who am I talking about? A man who came to power in a faraway country about 80 years ago. I am afraid for my country. Very afraid. Very, very afraid. Very, very, very afraid. Then Trump got into office, and his problem was almost exactly the opposite. He has a suck-up personality. I don't remember Hitler or Stalin going around saying, "These people are great, incredible, outstanding, quality people." The resistance is alarmed at all the nice things Trump says about Putin. This is what he said about North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. "He's got a great personality. He's a funny guy. He's very smart. He's a great negotiator. He loves his people. Not that I'm surprised by that, but he loves his people." It's way more annoying when he says this stuff about Chuck Schumer than when he says it about Kim or Putin. Trump is utterly undisciplined, runs his mouth, flatters everyone, and agrees with the last person he spoke to. Why, it's right out of the Mein Kampf playbook. In May 2018, the New York Times ran a review of former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright's book, Fascism, A Warning, titled, "Can It Happen Here?" The reviewer, Columbia professor Sherry Berman, wrote, "There are worrying parallels, warning Republicans that they must not allow the fervidness of Trump supporters to blind them to the danger to democracy that he represents." If that's what they're putting in the Times, you can imagine what the half-brights are saying. Unlike regular stupid people who know they're stupid, our media and showbiz elites think they're geniuses. They have a mollusk's grasp of historical concepts. Hitler, bad. Nazi, bad. Fascist, bad. Therefore, what's the worst thing Trump could be? Hitler! Trump is just like Hitler, trying to nail Playboy playmates. It's Hitlerian to defund Planned Parenthood, i.e., the closest our government comes to mass mechanized slaughter. Most of the things Trump does are neither here nor there, but some are kind of the opposite of Hitler. Attacking other countries on a flimsy pretext actually is Hitlerian. We bombed Syria for the same reason Hitler invaded the Sudetenland. Does anybody remember how the resistance reacted to that? MSNBC's Brian Williams soliloquized, "We see these beautiful pictures at night from the decks of these two U.S. Navy vessels in the Eastern Mediterranean. I am tempted to quote the great Leonard Cohen, 'I am guided by the beauty of our weapons.' And they are beautiful pictures of fierce armaments making what is, for them, a brief flight over to this airfield." What did they hit? The Virtue Signaling Industrial Complex. When the angel Obama was president, we always heard, "Never before has a president met with such instantaneous opposition to his very existence." He faced unprecedented levels of obstruction. An alleged conservative Republican senator, John McCain, announced that the Republican base's hatred of Mr. Obama was frightening. Obama was said to be genuinely startled by the intensity of the polarization he encountered. Poor Obama! Their show-stopping evidence of the unprecedented attacks was that Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said, on the eve of the 2010 midterm elections, that his goal was for President Obama to be a one-term president. Was that a news flash? Did the media expect the GOP to cancel the next presidential election because Obama was in office? New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman pronounced McConnell's remark deeply wrong. A Times editorial denounced McConnell's tooth and claw politicking. McConnell's hometown newspaper, the Courier Journal, issued a remorseful editorial saying McConnell had proved that he is a partisan before he is a patriot. Trump would trade what he's got for Obama's worst day. He'd trade it for Clinton's worst day. A Variety writer couldn't get through a movie review of Chappaquiddick without taking a shot at Trump. When you try to build a governing philosophy on top of lies, Owen Gleiberman wrote, one way or another, those lies will come back to haunt you. Hello, Donald Trump. He's an incompetent bully, but his middle name might be Liberal Karma. Wait, where did Trump come in? Olympic athlete Lindsey Vonn went out of her way to insult Trump before competing in the 2018 Winter Olympics, telling CNN that she would not accept an invitation to the White House. Absolutely not. Nope. No, I won't go. She didn't get the chance, losing all her races and heading home with one measly bronze, as USA Today put it. In a column on Bill Clinton's belated comeuppance for his comic horniness as governor and president, the Times' Maureen Dowd accused him of having Trump-level narcissism and selfishness. Weren't we talking about Clinton? A New Yorker article on New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman's beating up his girlfriends threw in the fact that his emotional state seemed to worsen after the 2016 presidential election. So at least there was a mitigating circumstance. In March 2018, a just-completed pedestrian bridge at Florida International University collapsed, crushing 8 cars beneath it and killing 6 people. Until that moment, the firm that built the bridge had bragged about being certified minority-owned and about the all-women design team on the project. So naturally, the most important thing to do after the fatal collapse was to virtue signal to the resistance. When the board hired me, FIU's president Mark Rosenberg said, I told them, if you give me a pile of rocks, I'm going to build a bridge, not a wall. The resistance, aka the hissy fit. Trump's election has marked a tossing off of all previous norms from every institution in America. The courts, the colleges, elected officials, civil rights activists, the states, feminists, late-night comedians, the swamp, athletes, the deep state, and of course the press and social media. Even the Pope. These days, the minimum irreducible proof of sanity in America is to be anti-Trump. In a post-election interview on May 2, 2017, Hillary Clinton blithely announced that she was now part of the resistance. It was a total break with American history. The losing side in an election is generally known as the loyal opposition. If Donald Trump had said such a thing about Hillary, or God forbid about Obama, it would have been taken as a Klan reference. There would have been demands to imprison him. He's issuing a call to violence. Resistance is a military term. It's a dog whistle to the militias and the KKK. What if Trump supporters then went on a violent rampage, donning masks and beating up Hillary supporters? I think everyone would recognize that we were in the middle of a fascist uprising. But Hillary's claim to be part of the resistance, followed by organized violence against conservatives, seems to alarm no one, apart from the people getting beaten up. After all, we're talking about Trump. Hundreds of young white liberals showed up at Trump's inauguration with the stated goal of making the historic event a giant cluster F, except they didn't say F. Under an umbrella group named Disrupt J20, the inauguration was on January 20th, self-described anti-capitalists, anti-fascists, and anarchists ran wild, smashing store windows, spray-painting cars, setting fires, and throwing bricks at cops and flares into police cars. About 200 of the rioters were arrested, but apart from the handful that pleaded guilty, not one has been convicted. The judge threw out one of the most serious charges against them, inciting a riot, because under the law, inciting a riot is defined as inviting Ann Coulter to give a speech. As the title of a Washington Post op-ed described the dangerousness of conservative speech, fiery rhetoric, a close relative of violence. Is violence a close relative of violence? Trump-era rules. Violence is speech, and speech is violence. The blue states are behaving like the worst southern governors during the civil rights era. We just can't get Democrats to live under the Constitution. If their side wins the White House, federal law rules supreme. Indeed, even the president's policy choice not to enforce federal law takes precedence over a state's preference to enforce federal law, enacted over decades of compromise by Republicans and Democrats and signed into law by U.S. presidents. But if their side loses the White House, states feel they are free to disregard not only the president's policy decisions, but the law and the Constitution. When Arizona passed a law in 2010 allowing state officers to enforce federal immigration law, despite President Obama's decision to ignore the law, Professor Stephen Vladeck, then of American University, said on CNN that, as long as the federal government can show that the state law is inconsistent with, and is indeed in conflict with federal policy, the state law must fail. That is exactly what follows from the Supremacy Clause, and the Supreme Court has recognized that really since the earliest years of the Republic. The Obama Justice Department argued in court that the Arizona law established its own immigration policy, i.e., enforcing the law, which was interfering with federal immigration law, i.e., Obama's policy preference. This, the government said, crossed a constitutional line. Democratic Congressman Luis Gutierrez, I have only one loyalty, and that is to the immigrant community, boasted on MSNBC that the lawyers for the Attorney General, the federal government, went in to see a federal judge and said, Supremacy Clause of the Constitution says we are in charge of enacting, developing all immigration law. And the judge says, yes, you are, federal government. But if their side loses, the Constitution's majestic Supremacy Clause goes out the window. The blue states are not only refusing to abide by federal law on immigration, but they're killing the wounded. California's Attorney General, Xavier Becerra, has threatened to go after private businesses that cooperate with federal immigration officers. Even George Wallace never threatened to go after businesses that refused to discriminate. I take it back. The resistance governors are worse than the massive resistance governors. Those guys didn't know what massive resistance was. Despite the clear constitutional and federal authority of the president to, 1, exclude immigrants in the best interests of the United States, and 2, enforce federal law, court after court has announced that President Trump cannot exclude any immigrants. He cannot enforce federal law against illegal immigrants who claim to have entered the country as minors, or for any other reason that Trump may announce in the future. In the next few months, each and every power the Constitution bestows on the president will be subject to a judge in Hawaii saying, I'm not so sure about that. Wouldn't we be in the same position if we had sent the squadron up the backside of the left hill rather than through the river on the right? Counselor, sagacious point, Your Honor. That's how we're going to fight wars in the 21st century. Comedy, or as Jimmy Kimmel has redefined it, declarative statement. The resistance has ruined comedy, which is now judged on the target of the joke, not on being funny. And the target is always Trump. Samantha Bee, the prototype modern comedian, editorializes instead of telling jokes. There will be no clever twists or surprise endings. A joke consists of a long string of invective with the humor measured by the number of syllables she uses. The carrot top, human shit-stained dumpster fire. Most comics couldn't look themselves in the mirror if they were doing the same routine every night. But when a mania has swept the country, taking the easy path can be richly rewarding. Did you hear that applause? And look, HuffPo's linking to us. In that environment, you have to have a lot of character to say, I'm going to do comedy. The few brave comedians still doing something that is recognizable as humor have to live in fear of the Revolutionary Committee censuring them for insufficient anti-Trumpiness. You tousled Donald Trump's hair. It was a comedy sketch. We are aware. You have been put on notice. No one alive will admit to having no sense of humor, but the fact is, some people don't. Under the new relaxed definition of comedy, where the host attacks agreed-upon hate figures, being a comedian is much easier. As long as they keep attacking Trump, the late-night comedy shows are guaranteed a minimum audience of 2 million viewers. You can't get below that. It's like trying to get below a C in college. The same lunatics watching Chris, Rachel, and Lawrence then flip the channel to Samantha, Stephen, and Jimmy. In fact, late-night comedy is largely indistinguishable from the news, except the comedians use more syllables and are even more historically illiterate than the cable news hosts. It must have been agonizing to pretend to care about people in Indiana. The bedrock of the old-style Democratic Party was economic fairness. But today, liberals love that income is wildly maldistributed, with them at the top. As long as they cut a check to BLM and fly a rainbow flag, they can live like 19th-century robber barons. Corporate America is delighted. I had no idea it was this easy. The rest of us can only sit trembling, waiting for the next great social justice warrior idea for remaking thousands of years of human history. Borders? Genders? What's next? Liberals live mostly in the moneyed areas on the coasts. With their basic subsistence needs taken care of, they are free to dedicate themselves to patrolling the borders of class. The party's new motto could be, keeping the bathwater and throwing out the baby. The left has no complaint with the rich. They are the rich. There will be no policing of Wall Street. Only internet memes and Twitter jokes are heavily policed for inappropriate humor. The resistance has become a hilarious version of the straights, the squares, the uptight businessman in his business suit going to the big office. They have become the man. Being woke is just another status symbol, proving they are elite enough to insulate themselves from the consequences of their BLM social justice warrior policies. Their kids will still get into Harvard. Trump gives snobs a wonderful opportunity. By sneering at him, they can make fun of the Walmart types without getting called on it, because they're technically talking about a rich man who is president. Hillary spoke to liberals' deepest beliefs when she called Trump supporters deplorables. The Democratic base loathes guns, Confederate monuments, steel workers, and Trump, because they all represent a certain kind of middle-class American. They care more about a female Yale law grad who didn't make partner at a fancy New York law firm than a union plant bookkeeper whose job has been outsourced to Mexico. In a way, it's more honest having liberals not bothering to pretend to like flyover people anymore. We'll tell you what's normal. We're told that Trump's is not a normal presidency, as serial fibber Brian Williams says every single night on MSNBC. What's normal is having the Department of Justice run guns to Mexico. That happened under Obama's Attorney General, Eric Holder. It's apparently normal to bound up the stairs and warmly embrace Cuban dictator Raul Castro, as Obama did at Nelson Mandela's funeral. It's normal to molest a White House intern half the president's age, then to commit a slew of felonies to cover it up, as you know who did. It's normal to bomb a foreign country out of the blue on the day of your scheduled impeachment. All that is normal. Trump has done nothing he didn't promise to do. In fact, he's done quite a bit less. It's not as if he got into office and announced, "I forgot to mention it, but I'm going to round up all children and turn their bones into toothpicks." From the reaction, he might as well have. For the resistance, the only organizing principle is, which position will be worse for Trump? Is Russia a colorful country with a noble history of giving socialism a try, or the most evil regime since Nazi Germany? Do I enjoy coarseness in popular culture, or am I a hothouse flower offended by dirty language? Am I enraged by the idea of the government secretly spying on American citizens, or is that a vital part of national security? Is it outrageous that private communications of the Democratic National Committee were publicly revealed on WikiLeaks during a campaign? Or is it totally fantastic that a secret recording of Trump, the Access Hollywood tape, was blasted all over the world a month before the election? Is transparency in government something that I support? Or do I think Trump has got to get off Twitter? A novel on independent thought that has occurred only to me. In that environment, we may give Trump more than the usual latitude if he acts as if he's under siege. He is under siege. Is he unhinged? No, he's hinged, fighting back against the left's infantile, knee-jerk reaction to everything he does. Instead of governing, Trump is spending his presidency refuting questions like, "Did you boil and eat a small child today?" It's one ginned-up fake story after another. And the people doing this are the most corrupt and conflicted in the history of the world. James Comey, Robert Mueller, Brian Williams, George Stephanopoulos, Nancy Pelosi, Hillary Clinton, and on and on. No puppet. You're the puppet. Nothing the Russians ever dreamed of could compare to what the resistance is doing to democracy, obliterating the will of Trump voters who wanted him to get to work on urgent problems. It is nothing less than a coup. It may be that Trump is beyond the reach of intelligent people trying to help him. But attacking him the way liberals do is not going to help. It just solidifies his base and leads them to defend everything he does. Liberals might even be right about some of their complaints, but the absurd charges make them sound insane. If one were inclined to go after Trump, there's no dearth of material. From a certain vantage point, he seems willing to say or do anything for an afternoon of semi-good publicity. It sure looks like he signed a bill that jettisoned his central campaign promise so he could spend the weekend at Mar-a-Lago. One might even say that he's abandoned all the popular issues he ran on. But the resistance doesn't notice any of that. It's the worst combo platter imaginable for Trump supporters. The Democrats have not suffered at all, but their base is white hot. My advice to the resistance is, Get Trump on the worst thing he's actually done and stop running off with, "Wouldn't it be great if he raped and murdered a nun?" You're right. If Trump had done that, he would be finished. Done. Put a fork in him. Unfortunately, he hasn't committed that particular crime. What the resistance is accusing him of is even crazier. Donald Trump plotted with the Ruskies to steal the election from the most qualified person ever to run for president. If you'd care to join me here on planet Earth, Trump is practically begging the media to go after him for not caring about any of the issues he ran on. But unfortunately, liberals have lost their minds. Chapter 2. The resistance has told thousands of lies about Trump. Here's one. Anyone who says Trump admitted, on tape, to committing sexual assault is a stone-cold liar and should never be trusted to deliver any facts honestly. The foundational symbol of the resistance is the pussy hat. This is based on a hot mic conversation Trump had when taping a TV segment for NBC's Access Hollywood 11 years earlier, which miraculously appeared on all our TV sets 1 month before the election. "I better use some Tic Tacs just in case I start kissing her. You know, I'm automatically attracted to beautiful. I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet. Just kiss. I don't even wait. And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything. Grab them by the pussy. You can do anything." Voters: "Got it. Okay, next." Media: "What do you mean, next?" What a threat Trump must be to the combine running our country, that they're willing to carefully husband a secretly recorded conversation with him for months and months throughout the primary, producing it only in the 11th hour as a kill shot. From the moment Trump started talking about the issues that no one else would, the ruling class rose up to try to strangle our movement. MSNBC deployed armies of interns to sit in real time, listening to every Howard Stern show, hoping for some spicy tidbit from Trump. TV networks searched the files for embarrassing hot mic moments. After going through the vault of his half-century public career, NBC emerged triumphant with the infamous Access Hollywood tape. Instead of reporting the news media participated in a stunt. Oddly, our media barely even noticed the worst part of the tape when Trump describes his pursuit of a married woman. "I moved on her like a bitch, but I couldn't get there," in his delicate phrasing. The married woman never came forward. "That was you hitting on me? You've got to get your game up." Nor did the media highlight the most hilarious part of Trump's seduction technique. He took the lady furniture shopping. "She wanted to get some furniture," he says. "I said, I'll show you where they have some nice furniture." I'm sorry, I love the guy, but who would turn to Donald Trump for decorating advice? How much for this Taj Mahal-themed bedroom set? No, what the stout defenders of family values in the mainstream media were upset about was that Trump used the P word. And God bless them, it was the media's titanic overreaction that saved him. Until 2 seconds before the Access Hollywood tape appeared, Ex Machina, these were the same people telling the rest of us to relax about raw sewage in television, performance art, college campuses, the theater, kindergarten classes, museums, fashion, and Hollywood. In a modern miracle, they became Victorian virgins the moment Trump used a bad word. Just a few years earlier, Eve Ensler, authoress of the celebrated Vagina Monologues, told MSNBC's Lawrence O'Donnell that thousands of women shouting "vagina" in public was one of the most thrilling times I've had in the almost 15 years of V-Day. You can guess what V-Day is. In fact, women shouting about their vaginas had become a big part of our rich cultural tapestry. Next up, Vogue magazine reviews the iconic vagina dress. A primetime ABC sitcom that was on air during the 2016 campaign, The Real O'Neills, included this bit of witty repartee. Mimi, we've been dating for 6 months, and you've never once pressured me to have sex, which is why I want to have sex. Mimi hands Kenny a large box of condoms. Kenny, wow, 48 condoms. Mimi, 12 didn't seem like enough. Jimmy, what did Mimi do to you? Kenny, oh, just, you know, just all that sex stuff that drives us wild. Jimmy, no matter what she, Mom, tells you, you're not going to hell. Trust me, if everything she said was true, I would be so blind by now. Kenny grabs Mimi's breast and immediately pulls his hand away. Kenny, your boobs feel squishy. In reviews of the show, there was a lot of sniffing about the Blue Noses, who didn't appreciate the daring wit. The New York Times TV reviewer sarcastically described the show as shocking. Or it would be, that is, if this were still the mid-20th century. The San Francisco Chronicle touted the show as both funny and credible. But that hasn't stopped pre-broadcast protests by conservative groups. As usual, the paper sniffed, someone, somewhere, somehow will object, and almost always without having seen the show. Newsday sadly remarked, in a world where everyone is offended by something, the real O'Neills won't escape unscathed. NBC News president Andy Lack, the zealot of liberal sexual abuse, held the network's interview with Juanita Broderick, accusing Bill Clinton of rape, until after his impeachment trial to protect the president. Lack was also the longtime employer of serial sexual harasser Matt Lauer, whom he paid $25 million a year. But when it came to Trump, it was Lack's network that breached all professional norms and probably the law in releasing the Access Hollywood tape weeks before the election. These fastidious cultural commissars were disgusted that Trump had used the P word in a private conversation. In fact, the ladies of the resistance were so offended, they started shouting pussy at the top of their lungs and marching around in pussy hats. You couldn't get away from all the delicate flowers hollering about their pussies and vaginas. This would be like Christians protesting the federal government's funding of Piss Christ, a Christ figurine submerged in urine, by waving around even more offensive images of Christ. A normal person would have to wonder, were you really that offended? Quite obviously, Trump was talking about celebrity culture, and with some degree of disapproval. His whole point was to cite something axiomatically unacceptable, grabbing women by the P-word, in order to say that celebrity culture was so out of whack that a celebrity could get away with it. He used the exact same construction when he said he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and not lose any of his voters. In both cases, he is using an absurd example of objectionable behavior to illustrate the intensity of either celebrity groupies or Trump fans. That's not a confession. It's hyperbole to make a point. They let you do it. Not if you're Trump. Because everything Trump does must be a crime, journalists went in about 10 seconds to, he's bragging about committing a sexual assault. The entire Fourth Estate pretended to hear something different from what they'd just heard. Trump said, they let you do it. I don't care how poor your command of English is. They let you do it means consent. You could win that case on summary judgment. Your Honor, he said, they let you do it. By definition, that's not an assault. Case dismissed. The media fixed the inconvenient problem of Trump's having said, "They let you do it," by simply editing that part out. Here was MSNBC's Lawrence O'Donnell's clip of the tape. Donald Trump: "When you're a star, you can do anything. Grab them by the bleep." And here's Chuck Todd's version on MTP Daily. Trump: "You can do anything." Billy Bush, TV host: "Whatever you want." Trump: "Grab them by the bleep. You can do anything." Here's CNN's version. Trump: "You can do anything." Bush: "Whatever you want." Trump: "Grab them by the pussy." Suspiciously missing in all of these clips are the words, "They let you do it." This allowed commentators to keep announcing, "We all heard the tape of him admitting that he forced himself on unwilling women." Can I see the tape again? No, they're all locked up. I don't feel like getting them. I thought it was only going to be MSNBC and a few of the riper nuts retailing the sexual assault nonsense. But no. The entire American media has been spreading this deliberate lie since the first journalist thought of it. In fact, Nexus can't perform a search for all the publications that have accused Trump of admitting to, quote, sexual assault, because it retrieves too many documents. Illustrating why the New York Times is considered a more serious newspaper than the Washington Post, this lie has appeared twice as often in the Post as it has in the Times. You probably don't believe me, so here are a few examples. New York Times editorial, first sentence: "And so, we have now heard the Republican nominee for President of the United States bragging about repeated sexual assault." MSNBC's Chris Hayes: "A president who admitted to and boasted about repeated sexual assault." Moderator Anderson Cooper at the second presidential debate: "That is sexual assault. You bragged that you committed sexual assault." Jeffrey Toobin: "I think you know, that is a very significant point about where we are as a country, that you can get elected president of the United States after admitting sexual assault." Lawrence O'Donnell, October 10th, 2016, and every single night of his show: "Donald Trump was heard on videotape admitting to sexual assault." The Washington Post, Dana Milbank: "The Access Hollywood video, in which Trump boasts in vulgar terms about sexually assaulting women." Brian Fallon, CNN political commentator: "Donald Trump could basically admit on tape to committing sexual assault and then win the presidency anyway." The New York Times' Charles Blow: "Trump even admitted to a pattern of sexual assault on tape." And finally, on September 18th, 2017, Hillary Clinton, America's most famous sexual assault defender, cited that really horrible video of Trump admitting to sexual assault. "He said they let you do it." What Trump actually said was juvenile. That wasn't enough. The media had to accuse him of admitting to sexual assault? It would be like attacking Anthony Weiner for being a serial killer. But he didn't kill anyone. Yes, but if he were a serial killer, it would be much worse. True, but he didn't kill anyone. Yeah, it's Trump's fault that no one believes the media. This is how journalists repel people who are perfectly willing to be appalled by Trump. He drives them away, and the media keep pulling them back. Chapter 3, Bald-Faced Lie Number 2. Take a hacking joke. The story pops up every few weeks as if it were Alger Hiss's Prothonotary Warbler. "We've got the proof. Trump is on tape asking Putin to hack Hillary's emails." You'll never hear the tape, only journalist summaries. So I'll transcribe what Trump actually said. Quote, I will tell you this, Russia. If you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing. I think you will probably be rewarded mightily by our press. The resulting hysteria is an example of one of the left's favorite weapons, deployed constantly in the Trump era, not getting jokes. When The Nation magazine does it, they probably really don't get it. But I have to believe the rest of the media are using the not getting jokes routine cynically. No one could be that stupid. In 2008, John McCain showed up at the Sturgis motorcycle rally and said, You know, I was looking at the Sturgis schedule and noticed that you have a beauty pageant, and so I encouraged Cindy to compete. I told her with a little luck, she could be the only woman ever to serve as both the First Lady and Miss Buffalo Chip. You may not like the joke. You could say it's corny, but it's a joke. Not to liberals. PBS's Bonnie Irby grimly informed viewers that in the Miss Buffalo Chip contest, female contestants are often scantily clad. Whether McCain knew this or not is not known. MSNBC's Rachel Maddow was shocked, saying, I mean, these are prepared remarks, which means he thought in advance about nominating his visibly horrified wife to take part in a biker beauty pageant. And the biggest girl of them all, Keith Olbermann, spent an entire segment on McCain's joke on his MSNBC show, asking in astonishment, was it an off day? Was it a tired candidate caught up in a strange kind of event? Or whatever it was, does this pose a political problem? With Trump, the feminist hostile takeover of the left is complete, reviving the old joke. Question, how many feminists does it take to screw in a light bulb? Answer, that's not funny. The media spent an entire day in 2018 somberly analyzing General John Kelly's remark on his promotion from Homeland Security Secretary to White House Chief of Staff. I did something wrong and God punished me, I guess. Audience laughs. Pro tip. When the audience laughs, it was probably a joke. Liberals are willing to act like naive idiots so they can't be accused of insincerity. Mick Jagger confessed to killing the Kennedys. I have it on tape right here. I shouted out, who killed the Kennedys, when after all, it was you and me. I don't know who you are, but we know Mick Jagger killed the Kennedys. In Russia scandal, hacks email you. The not getting jokes strategy has grown into a monster in the age of Trump. If you want to annoy a journalist, tell him his problem is that voters take Trump seriously but not literally, whereas the media take him literally but not seriously. Oh, so we shouldn't take the President of the United States at his word? The Washington Post's Jennifer Rubin has denounced the literally-seriously distinction in 40 separate columns. E.g., Note to Trump and Thiel, the president is always taken literally. Throw in columnists James Homan and Paul Waldman, and the Post's op-ed page spends half its time being angry about not being allowed to take the president's jokes literally. So let's take Trump literally. When he said he hoped the Russians could find the 30,000 emails that are missing, he was obviously referring to the emails Hillary had scrubbed from her private server. As indicated, 30,000 of Hillary's government emails were missing. Only 20,000 of the DNC's emails ended up on WikiLeaks, and as indicated, they were not missing. It was kind of the opposite of missing. They were all over the internet. On July 5th, 2016, just a few weeks before Trump's joke, FBI Director James Comey had released his report confirming that Hillary's deleted emails, one, were unrecoverable, and two, might have been hacked. The hacking, if there was any, was done. It was over. Hillary's 30,000 emails were gone, departed, lost, annihilated, like a Tom Arnold sitcom pilot. It would make no sense for Trump to ask Russia to hack her 30,000 emails because they weren't on the private server anymore. There were no emails to hack. That's why he did not say hack. He said missing. What Trump was saying, literally, was, hey, Russia, if you have this stolen property that belongs to the American people, please return it to its rightful owners. In a sane world, Trump would have been honored as Man of the Year at the White House Correspondents' Dinner for demanding the retrieval of U.S. government property. Trump wasn't even the first one to make this joke. A month after Hillary's private server was revealed in 2015, Kimberly Guilfoyle said on Fox News, maybe Trey Gowdy can cut a deal with the Russians and get all the emails and all the correspondence that Hillary conveniently deleted. In his presidential announcement speech, Governor Bobby Jindal of Louisiana said Russian hackers were more likely to see the secretary's emails than the American people were. At the first GOP debate, Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin said, it's sad to think right now, but probably the Russian and Chinese governments know more about Hillary Clinton's email server than the members of the United States Congress. Politico, the UK's Daily Mail, and the New York Times all cited that as one of the best lines of the debate. The press got the joke, until Trump made it. These dour journalists, who claim it is of the utmost importance to take the president literally at all times, quoted Trump as saying something he literally did not say. Hack. He said, find. The ubiquity of this mistake is not an accident. It deliberately changes his meaning from asking Russia to return emails that were stolen to asking Russia to hack Hillary's emails. My editor hates when I give 800 examples, so you're getting only a few. Jonathan Lemire, Associated Press. Trump called upon Russia to hack his opponent Hillary Clinton's emails. Michael Cranish, The Washington Post. Trump repeatedly praised Russian President Vladimir Putin while urging the country's leaders to hack into his opponent's emails. Austin Goolsbee, economic advisor to President Obama. He's the guy that asked Russia to hack into emails and release them for Hillary Clinton. Colbert King, The Washington Post. Trump's call during the presidential primary for Russia to hack Hillary Clinton's emails. Michael Grunwald, Politico. Trump's public invitation to Russia, if you're listening, to hack Clinton's emails at a campaign press conference. Julie Hirschfeld Davis, The New York Times. Mr. Trump praised Mr. Putin effusively and exhorted Russia, in what aides now call a joke, to hack into Hillary Clinton's email. Chris Saliza, CNN Wire. Trump holds a press conference in which he openly urges Russia to hack into Hillary Clinton's private email server. And finally, Blake Hounshell, deputy editor, Politico Magazine. We already know Trump said publicly at a rally, Russia, if you're listening, please hack Hillary Clinton's emails. This isn't paraphrasing. It's lying. Chapter 4. Trump is a racist. We've scientifically proved it. Every few weeks, David Leonard at the New York Times or one of the low testosterone boys at Vox produce a scientific proof that Trump is a racist. We ran the numbers. It's official. Trump is a racist. The list of Trump's alleged racism is meaningless unless one accepts the input. That's how liberals get stunning figures on things like white domestic terrorism compared to Islamic terrorism. White trash degenerates yelling racist insults at a group of African Americans in Douglasville, Georgia, resulting in a combined punishment of 19 years in prison, counts as one incident of terrorism. Omar Mateen murdering 49 people at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando also counts as one incident of terrorism. Similarly, when it comes to the Times' alleged proofs of Trump's racism, we've looked at the data and we don't agree, he said A. You are wrong on B. He meant something else about C. The list includes, for example, Trump's demand to see Obama's birth certificate. Everyone knows what that's about. Not necessarily, any more than it was anti-white for people to question whether John McCain was eligible to be president, having been born in the Panama Canal Zone. In the 1880 presidential election, Flinty Vermonter Chester Arthur was accused of being born in Canada. Racists! Oh, wait. Arthur was white, too. So is Canada. The Times' litany of Trump's alleged racism also includes his call for the reinstitution of the death penalty after the Central Park Wilding attack. Not convinced? The brute continued to insist the convicts were guilty more than 10 years after DNA evidence had exonerated them, as Leonhardt says. DNA evidence didn't convict them, so it couldn't exonerate them. It was always known that the DNA matched none of the defendants and other attackers got away, as the prosecutor told the two multiracial juries that convicted them. The new DNA evidence merely identified one of the ones who got away. The reason Trump continues to say they were guilty is that they were guilty. See Demonic, How the Liberal Mob is Endangering America, Chapter 12. David Leonhardt, do me a solid, America, and simply agree with my headline. Don't be thinking you're going to be looking at the evidence. No Nazi. You're the Nazi. For most of the resistance, all you have to do is say Charlottesville to prove that Trump is the leader of the Fourth Reich. The more the rally recedes in time, the fresher a memory it becomes. In June 2018, film director Spike Lee was still droning on about it at a meeting of the oppressed, the Cannes Film Festival. We have a guy in the White House, I'm not going to say his bleeping name, whose defining moment, it was not just for Americans, for the world, and that bleep was given a chance to say, we are about love and not hate, and that bleep did not denounce the bleeping Klan, the alt-right, and those Nazi bleeps. In fact, of course, Trump has condemned neo-Nazis and the Klan until he's blue in the face. He did during the campaign, when he was asked about his feelings toward David Duke more often than he was asked about any policy issue. He denounced them again in his remarks on Charlottesville, a violent melee resulting entirely from the connivance of local politicians and the criminal incompetence of police brass. Trump's crime wasn't his failure to condemn Nazis, there's no such thing, or white supremacists. His crime was saying, I think there is blame on both sides. The media had been very clear that this was not what they wanted him to say, but he didn't submit to their will, so they called him a racist. In his first remarks, Trump condemned, in the strongest possible terms, this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides, on many sides. That statement led to days of hysteria. Trump was condemned by spaghetti-spined Senate Republicans. Executives on his American Manufacturing Council resigned en masse. Ivanka was said to rebuke her father by issuing the media-approved condemnation on Twitter. Why wouldn't the president bend to the media's will? Ivanka, Jared, and Chief of Staff John Kelly all begged Trump to roll on his back like Fido for the media. Steve Bannon recommended that Trump be kept away from the media altogether. Trump, according to the moral paragons in the press, had a special obligation to condemn white nationalists because of the media's fantasy that Trump is a racist. It gets rather circular. What if the media had decided to claim Trump was a child molester? Would he be required to condemn every child molester in the country and then have his words dissected and analyzed by Trumpologists? With more basis in fact, some Americans believed Obama was born in Kenya. Perhaps they should have called on him to condemn the droughts and post-election unrest in that country. But that didn't happen.